What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Annette Gordon-Reed, the Carl M. Loeb University Professor at Harvard University, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She lives in New York and Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome, Annette, and thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I often start with my guests asking them about who they are, who their family is, where and how they grew up. And that's usually a shorter conversation, but it feels like we need to elongate that for this conversation, because it's a critical part of the story and the way that you talk about Juneteenth. So let's start with being a native Texan, growing up in Texas.
Okay.
What was that like?
Well, I was born in a small town in Texas, and my family, when I was an infant, moved to another small town in Texas, Conroe, Texas. I was born in Livingston, moved to Conroe, Texas. That's technically East Texas. Culturally, that's what it is. And East Texas, unlike what people probably think mainly about Texas, is not a desert. It is a big pine forest, essentially, the big thicket in that area. It's huge, covers a huge swath of eastern Texas, and it was a plantation society, and you can imagine what it was like from that it was a place that after the end of slavery had Jim Crow, and indeed it was still going on when I was born. I had two older brothers. I was the youngest child, a girl, and the five of us lived in Conroe and grew up in a really interesting time, a time that started out a place where a lot of changes were being made in the country with the civil rights movement and so forth. And so I kind of watched the evolution of this place, a segregated place, to a desegregated place, but a place where even still today, the kind of hierarchies of race are still present. So that's basically hometown, small town life, riding your bike, running around, doing various things, very different from being in a city. And with the whole business about Texas as a special place, something that was inculcated into us from the very, very beginning. So that's pretty much the story.
Yeah, you say in the book you took Texas history twice in school. You did more than watch the changes happen. I read that you actually integrated a school in your town. What was that experience like, and how did it shape your worldview?
Well, it was very, very intense. This was 10 years after Brown, and school districts throughout the South were still resisting, you know, integration. And had come up with all of these plans designed to keep things as they were before. And they came up with something called a freedom of choice plan. And which sounds good, you know, freedom of choice. But the expectation was that white parents would choose white schools and black parents would choose black schools. My parents decided to choose a white school to send me to. And we could talk about later why they made that decision, but they did. And I ended up integrating our town schools. It was not like, you know, the famous picture of Ruby Bridges being escorted in by marshals and so forth, or the other people in Little Rock and other places. The idea was that a big deal would not be made of it. And I would just kind of come to school like it was a normal thing. And my father brought me to school that first day. And I went into the first grade, Mrs. Daughtry's first grade class. It was an intense period because I understood that it was something important. I didn't know how important, but I did know that it was obviously out of the ordinary going to a white school. My mother taught at what was called the black school, Booker T. Washington. It was K through 12th grade. And I knew that, and I'd gone there as a kindergartner, so I knew that Black kids went to school typically with Black kids, and white kids went to school with white kids. So I knew it was a big change. And some of the kids were nice, and some of them weren't. And so you can imagine, you think about how kids can be rough on one another, even in the best of circumstances. And this was a very unusual circumstance. But there were some people who were good people. My teacher was wonderful. She could not have been better in terms of making sure that nobody really, you know, got out of line with me when they were available, if she was around. So it was intense, but I actually enjoyed it because I enjoyed school. You know, I mean, I was a good student. And so I don't know what it would have been like if I had been a person who didn't like school or wasn't good at school, but I was. And so that gave me a leg up. But my mother said at one point I broke out in hives, and she thinks that might have been stress related. I don't remember that, but it's like anything in your life. You remember the better things as opposed to the bad things. But it was intense. And about 3 years later, almost 3 years later, the Supreme Court declared the freedom of choice plans unconstitutional. And then everybody had to change schools. And I basically was already there at Anderson. And so that was the big upheaval came in the town later on when these plans were struck down.
A couple of threads that I want to tug on there, as you were talking. So I raised my daughter, you know, in a very much an activist home, a revolutionary home. I do work around state terror. And one of the things she talks about now is like the weight as a Black child, knowing all of the things that she knew, mm-hmm. and having to confront the violence of white supremacy, and violence, not necessarily physically violence, right?
Psychological
violence of white supremacy. And how that impacted her. And I did hitch a breath when I read that she integrated in school, because I did have Little Rock images in my head and Ruby Bridges in my head. And also, and I want to get into some of this too, right? My stereotypes about what Texas is. So about that weight. I guess you talked about it because you talked about the hives. Mm-hmm. Any other ways you think that weight shaped you, carrying that weight?
Well, I think it shaped me in a positive way, in the sense that it made me think about, it made me think about race. It made me think about history, because I had to think of, you know, why was this a big deal? Do you know? I mean, I didn't have the sophistication to work it all out, but I knew this must be the result of something. Something got us to this point where this is a big deal. And so I think it made me think about history. It also made me think about law, that maybe the beginnings of my thinking about how law changes things, because that was very much in the air. You know, I didn't understand all the contours, the depth of it, but I knew that lawyers had played a role in bringing all of this about. So it's not a surprise that I've become a lawyer and a historian, because it made me look at the world in a particular kind of way. What it made me do was to think about why the people who were unkind to me, the people who didn't want this to happen, what's going on with them? Because I never thought there was anything wrong with me. I mean, I knew I hadn't done anything. And right. To the extent that there were people who were hostile to me, I had a loving family, you know, grandparents who were doting grandparents. I thought I was a pretty good person, right? It was something wrong with them. It wasn't me. And so I think the process of trying to figure out what makes people like that tick started early on. And that's sort of what my career has been about. Since then, is to try to figure that picture out. So there was a negative side of it, but there was the positive side that it made me aware, because, you know, I could have, again, I think this is tied up with the fact that I was good at what I was doing then. I think if I had been struggling, that would have been another, you know, brick in the wall. I mean, there'd been another problem if I'd had to do that, but I was a good student. And so, you know, I think I made things easier for my teacher, but it was easier for me because I had only one kind of struggle to deal with, and that's trying to figure out what's the matter with these people, the ones who were hostile to me. And then there were some who you know, I talk about in the book who were very kind. And so that gave me another look at the world to say that not everybody has the same ideas about these things. So it just made me, I think it made me a thoughtful person because there was just a lot to figure out very early on.
You know, I get to talk to a lot of people doing this work, and it's fascinating to me how many Black folks I talk to that have that story of being a kid and trying to process racism. It happened to me the first time I was eight, first time someone called me the N-word.
Yeah.
And I stayed up all night.
Oh, wow.
Trying to wrap my brain around. And I'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I saw the sun come up. Wrap my brain around how someone could hate me because I was brown.
Black.
I couldn't. Which says something, right, about children.
Yeah.
And the fresh slate that they are. And then and then we mess it all up.
Well, I mean, it was very helpful to me to have my parents and my family, I mean, to come back to a community where, you know, generally where people were, certainly my family, were very supportive, you know. So this could have gone a lot of different ways without the kind of support system that I had. My basic personality, I think, to start, and also the support system that I had.
Well, let's spend a couple of minutes talking about your parents. Mm-hmm. Tell us about them. And I am interested in why they chose to have you integrate the school and then the politics around that.
Yeah. So as I said, my mother was an English teacher. She taught high school English and at Booker T. Washington School until integration. And then when integration came, they took a lot of Black teachers out of the classroom. That was one of the things that I don't think people had really anticipated or thought through in the same way. But she remained in the classroom and she went to teach at the white high school once everything got mixed together. And my father, so she was a teacher. She had grown up in Texas. All of my family's from Texas, as far back as I can remember, as I can discern actually from doing any kind of genealogy. We're basically Texans. But she had gone away to Spelman College and come back to TSU for graduate school, but didn't go to get a PhD. She was married and had kids, and she just got her master's degree and then started to teach. My father didn't go to college. He went into the army to help support his younger sisters. His mother had died when he was 11 and his father was raising them alone. And he went off to Korea and came back and started a business. He had the kind of businesses that Black men could have at that time. He owned a funeral home. He owned a store. Not really that great as a businessman. He was a little too soft-hearted for that. He would give people food if they couldn't pay, you know, and you can't really do that. But both of them were very well-read. They believed in reading. We had books in our house all the time. I mean, my encounter with books came through them and the books that they had. And this was, as I said, in the 60s, they had all the kinds of books that you would expect that were the big books at the Black Rage, all those kinds of things that were, you know, would be on a typical shelf at the time period. So they were very, very political people. And I think that is why they decided to send me to Anderson Elementary School. They, you know, I wondered about myself. I have two kids who went to schools that were predominantly, there were majority white schools But there were Black people there. I mean, there are more Black people there, you know, than even after it was integrated in my particular school in Conroe, because they tended to be in other schools. But, you know, they thought, and I wondered if I would do the same thing, and I would probably say no. It would have been something that I would have been concerned about. But I think they thought that they were part of a movement. I mean, this was in the 60s, and there was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. They were part of something. So it wasn't like they were doing something alone. They saw themselves as part of a journey and of advancement, that this is what they were supposed to do. So it was a political thing to do. Now, later on, I think they were a bit disillusioned with how things had turned out, because even though there was integration, as I mentioned before, I think the hierarchy remained the same. The power hierarchy remained pretty much the same. And Black students lost role models because Black teachers, many of the Black teachers, and this didn't just happen in my hometown, it happened all across the South, were taken out of the classroom. And so Black students didn't have role models, and white students didn't get to have Black people as role models, as teachers. And so the whole thing sort of changed. I think my mother, you know, felt particularly not lost, but a little disappointment, because she had gone to college to teach Black students. I mean, again, they were part of that, we're on a journey, you know, Black, uplift the race, that kind of thing. And then when they had integration, because there's so few Black people in our town, relatively, it's not a town, it maybe 5%, 6%, most of her students were white. And she loved her students. And one of the great things is to have people tell me now that they were her students and how much she meant to them, Black people and white people. But that wasn't why she had gone to school, because she thought she had a special mission. So I think there was a little bit of not buyer's remorse. I mean, she wasn't nostalgic for Jim Crow, being told where you could sit in the movie theater, or where you had to go, you know, the separate waiting room, tiny waiting room, and when you went to the doctors. But something was missing from this for her. And so that's not something that they thought about, I think. So they did it because it was the political thing to do, they thought at the time, that this was part of a process that was going on in the country. And then later on, wouldn't have wanted to go back to Jim Crow, but did realize that they had not maybe looked at the entire, you know, field before this great change came over our town.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Annette Gordon-Reed, who has a new book out on Juneteenth. All right, let's get to talking about Juneteenth, June 19th, 1865. What happened on that day?
Well, General Gordon Granger comes into Galveston, Texas, which was the big important city in Texas at the time. We always think about Houston as the place now, or Dallas, but Galveston, which was the port, was the big deal. And he comes from New Orleans over to make the announcement that slavery is over in Texas. Now, the story we used to tell sort of as a joke was, wait a minute, the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed in 1863. Why is he coming in 1865 to say that slavery is over? And people said, well, you know, it's sort of jokingly, well, you know, white people wanted another couple of years to get in the harvest, yeah, something like that. And that was the kind of joke and that they would tell. And people asked me, well, why didn't Black people know about the Emancipation Proclamation? Well, they knew about the Emancipation Proclamation. It was in the newspaper. Anything that white people knew that was in the papers, Black people knew at that time. It's just that the army in Texas kept fighting. I mean, Lee surrenders in April of 1865, and the army in Texas doesn't surrender until June of 1865. And most people think the war is over in April, but it's not. I mean, it was in a real sense it was over because the battle was lost, but they kept fighting. So it wasn't until they surrendered June 2nd that Granger and the United States Army could make the plans to go into Texas and say, it's over. And that's why we get to June 19th. He's there, and the story is that he read this proclamation, General Order Number 3, I should say, on a balcony of the place where he was living. He may have done that, but the troops went through Galveston and they posted on an African Methodist Episcopal Church, General Order Number 3 saying that slavery is over, and they announced it in different places. So from then on, there has been some kind of celebration of Juneteenth. Wasn't called Juneteenth, it was Emancipation Day at that time. But celebration of this holiday from that moment. So from there, we have the beginnings of a holiday that was at first kind of controversial in the sense that enslavers were upset about this. And so when people celebrated, they punished people. One of the things that I found was a story about this town where dozens of Black people were whipped for celebrating Juneteenth. So it was just a moment that was happy, but fraught. And sometimes people ask me, should this be a celebration or is this a commemoration or how should you see it? And I mean, I think it's both. It's a celebration. I think Black joy is a thing. And these people were in fact happy that the legalized theft of their children, of their labor, and all of that was over. I mean, they found other ways to achieve this, but the legal being treated as a chattel was over. And so I think that's something that they were happy about, and we can take, you know, we can respect and take joy in their joy about that. But they also knew it was going to be a tough road, and it was, and has been still a tough road for Black people in Texas. So the idea was to, you know, in the book, talk about June 19th, 1865, and to talk about me integrating the schools in our town. I was part of that journey. It's a part of the journey from emancipation that we are African-Americans are still on today.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to talk about that a little later in the interview, but I'll segue to it now. I mean, I know that I have struggled, might not be the wrong word, but I've held the contradictions around Juneteenth, right? Like, so I'm of the mindset slavery is not ended in this country. It's just in prison yards.
Oh, my father used to say that. They haven't freed the slaves yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, right. I mean, slavery is illegal unless you're convicted. And there's so many of our people inside of prisons across this country. Mm-hmm. Life for Black people is still pretty rough in America. How do you, I mean, I guess you just talked about how you hold those contradictions. But yeah, it's definitely been.
No, it's definitely there. It's definitely there. I mean, and they knew it was going to be there because they knew who they were dealing with. I mean, they lived with these people and had been mistreated by these people for centuries. And this was not going to go away immediately, but whatever freedom, whatever space they had to do something, they were determined to make the most of it. And so that's why I can see them both together, because I do know that they understood that this was going to be a journey. This is going to be a fight. And it has been.
Two-part question, though you've answered part of it already. Growing up in Texas, this Juneteenth sits in your body, your DNA, differently than it does mine. Mm-hmm. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. And you also say, it might even be on the first page of the book, but it's early on, that when people begin to talk more about Juneteenth, us folks outside of Texas, that you were initially annoyed. Why?
Well, because it started out as a holiday for Black people. Right. And Black people in Texas. And as a child, I would have had a very proprietary notion about that because, you know, it was the Black version of July 4th. I mean, we celebrated, we did fireworks and stuff on the 4th too, but this was really supposed to be our holiday. So I came to think of it as ours. And that lasted until I got to be an adult. And then I found that other people were celebrating it, knew something about it, and were celebrated in other parts of the country. And it just hadn't dawned on me. It hadn't occurred to me until, you know, later on that this is because a lot of Black people who left Texas took the holiday with them and sort of explained it to people and kept celebrating it wherever they were, in California or Illinois, mainly out west, I think, is where most Black Texans who left Texas went. They went west, they tended to. And then I realized that's a, you know, that's pretty mean-spirited thing to say that this is something that belongs to us. It's an advance in human rights. It's a focusing in on the notion of human rights. And everybody should be willing to celebrate that. And if they are, to talk about the recognize the evil of slavery and to see that this was a blow struck against it, didn't kill it, but it was at least a blow against it, they should be able to celebrate that. And so then I thought, yeah, sure, fine. It's great. And then, of course, now it's a national holiday, which was not what I wrote the book for, but it was nice. The book came out in May, and then they made it a national holiday. And so now it has that, more people know about it than would have known about it otherwise.
All right, now we're getting into some more controversial water, because yes, more people are celebrating Juneteenth, and there's been some stories in the news about white folks being the ones to coordinate, organize, and want to lead the celebration of Juneteenth. And mm-hmm. this controversy in the middle of a conversation in movement, right, where Black folks asserting our right, our need, yeah. and to lead around our issues, and some of our white relatives struggling with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know... This is a holiday that has to do with both of us, but this is our, you know, birthright. This is our story in a way that it is not their story. And it's good to have people if they want to be allies, but they have to understand how best to do that, as opposed to trying to take things over. As I said, it was primarily a Black Texas holiday when I was growing up. In 1980, the state made it a state holiday in Texas. And so it's been kind of a joint thing where Blacks and whites were both involved in it. But yeah, people doing some very sort of questionable celebrations too, in some of the retail retail areas, you know, Juneteenth watermelon or something.
A few
years back.
Yeah, the Greenville thing where the advertisement for the Juneteenth celebration was a white couple.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, okay,
lost,
you know,
their minds a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's going overboard. People want to say, oh, this is a holiday for everybody, but you got to have Black people in there. You know, you just can't. You can't just, that doesn't quite work. You know, to X Black people out of it. It doesn't make any sense. Make any sense.
At all. You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Annette Gordon Reed, who's got a new book out on Juneteenth. I am a storyteller, so when I saw the words origin stories, spent some time in that part of the book, origin stories versus history, mm-hmm. the difference between the two and why each matters to a people.
Mm-hmm. Well, the origin stories are part true in some ways. They're the kinds of things that we fixate on to try to tell us who we are. We need to have some understanding about, or some, we human beings, some beliefs about who we are. The history is something different, because you try as much as you can to get to the reality of the situation, the truth of the situation. Your origin story may not give the whole picture, the complete picture of it. And what I was suggesting with that is that we tend to think of the beginning of the Black or African presence in the United States in 1619 in Jamestown. I mean, Native peoples, the first contact is 1609 with Dick and the English coming to Virginia. But the truth is, there were people of African descent in the Americas in the 1500s. Some of them were enslaved, some of them were not. And I have a particular focus on Texas. I mentioned Florida because obviously St. Augustine is the bigger settlement and so forth, and people know about that in the 1500s. But Estebanico, the man that I write about in the book, is a Black man who was with the Spaniards in the 1520s in the area of Galveston. Galveston keeps coming up here in this story. And they get shipwrecked off the coast of Galveston, and then they end up walking almost to California to try to find a Spanish fort to rescue them. And in the process, Estebanico, who had a talent for languages, becomes a translator for Native peoples, indigenous people, and the Spaniards. And so it was a different look to things, a different beginning story. And I guess the point for me is that people of African descent should look to people like that as part of our origin story as well, not just the English-speaking people, because they were all affected by white supremacy, whether they were speaking Spanish or speaking French or speaking English, these notions about who could be enslaved, who could be at the bottom of a hierarchy affected people of African descent, no matter where they were and no matter what kind of language they spoke. And they all did things in resistance to that.
Then thread the history needle. Mm-hmm. Inside of that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, people think of Texas today as a white place. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of, and I say in the book, Texas is a white man. It is constructed as a white man. And my point is that from the very beginning, Texas was diverse. Not like a state that had to become diverse over time. It started out that way. Obviously, with the many indigenous groups who were in Texas, and then the Spanish come along and they have people of African descent with them, then Anglo-Europeans come along, English-speaking people come along, and Texas was a place after its settlement, and I should say from the beginning of its settlement, that was supposed to accommodate slavery. The people who came to Texas, many of them were from Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi. In fact, my relatives, my ancestors, I should say, on my father's side had been brought from Georgia. And on my mother's side, from Alabama and Mississippi, to be a part of the Cotton Empire that was created. And most people think about Texas as I said, the West. Two, it's a white man, and not only a white man, but he's a white cowboy, mm-hmm. a white cattle rancher, a white oil man, but not the white enslaver. That's not a part of the mythology. That exists for Virginia and Alabama and those other places. But this was that's why Texas, Stephen F. Austin, the father of Texas, the families that he brings in there as the impresario who is bringing settlers in, he says in a couple of letters, that if white people came to Texas without slaves, they could expect to be poor for a very, very long time. So the expectation was always that Anglo settlers and some French people as well from Louisiana who would come over were going to have slaves with them. And now this was a problem because Mexico had outlawed slavery. Mm. And that immediately put the Texians, as they were called, in conflict with Mexico. And even though they were given a special dispensation, they never you know, to hold their slaves because they understood why these people were coming and the expectations they had. The Texans never really trusted Mexico on this point, that eventually they would press the point about slavery. So that is a part of the story, a part of the history that a lot of people don't focus on when we talk about the Alamo and the Battle of San Jacinto and all those things and the brave Texans fighting off the Mexicans who are portrayed as the bad guys. Well, for African-American people, the Mexicans were not the bad guys. It was the Texians. When people, sort of a twist, when we think about slavery and people running away from slavery, escaping slavery, most people think of following the North Star and going north. Texans went south to Mexico because it would be free territory. So this history is a history that is suffused with slavery. It's a history that's suffused with diversity, different types of people, different languages, different races, different religions, all in this place from the very, very beginning. And it kind of has helped shape Texas. If you think of Texas as white and English or white and German, a lot of German immigrants into Texas, you're missing a whole part of what this place, what the place was all about, and why the tensions that we have today are present. They grow out of this legacy that we have because of the history of this place, the very complicated history of the state.
Why this book now, and what is your hope for this book in the world?
Well, my editor has always wanted me to do a big book about Texas. And he wanted me to write something sort of like the Hemingses of Monticello, but to do it with my family. So to tell the history of Texas through my family story. And I'd resisted that. And so far, I'm still resisting it, doing a big book about it. This is a pandemic book. I was in New York when the pandemic struck. Harvard had closed, and we all went home, and we were doing classes and so forth online. And then when school was out, I was here at sort of ground zero in Manhattan for the pandemic. And we did nothing but, you know, take a walk occasionally out in Central Park and then coming back. And I was thinking about my parents. I was wondering, you know, what would my parents make of this situation where the whole world has sort of been held hostage by this virus? And I missed them. And I started thinking it might be a good idea to write about them. Writing about them would help bring them back in a way to sort of remember our lives together. I also started thinking about Texas. And, you know, Juneteenth had come by, and then there was George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, had lots of people thinking about Juneteenth, lots of people thinking about slavery. And this is part of a legacy of slavery and the racial hierarchy that was created. So there were just a number of things that came together. I had the time. I couldn't do the kind of research that I normally do for go to archives and things like that, but it was going to be a small book, a short book, we decided, not the big book. And so it was a pandemic book that was born of my desire to sort of connect to my parents again and to talk about Texas, because I get people who ask me, I've been in the Northeast since I was 18. I went away to college, and people ask me, what's up with Texas? What's going on there? And I thought that this was a way to try to explain it. I don't know if I succeed, but I do hope that I've gotten people out of this notion that Texas is a white man. That people have to understand that's a very, very diverse, dynamic place. And it is a voter suppressed place, you know, where people don't, in many ways, are thwarted in efforts to vote and to participate in politics. But if they could, it would be a very different story. And the only hope is that one day it will be able to live up to the people, the worth of the people who are there.
I drove through Texas once, mm-hmm. coming from Illinois. It was unnerving. Right now, like, we're in this conversation, this national, I'm calling it a debacle, as the country talks about reproductive rights.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Texas GOP just put forth in their platform, they're seeking the death penalty for folks who provide abortions.
Yes, yes.
Or women who get them. And really, we're talking about, right, like, mm-hmm. low-income women of color.
Oh, absolutely.
Primarily. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. No, it's hard. It's hard because, as I say, there are things that I like about it because my family is there. You know, unlike many African-American families, my husband's family is from Arkansas. They sort of, as a group, just picked up and moved out to California and Arizona. They all left. My family remained in Texas. They left small towns and went into Houston or San Antonio or Dallas. So I don't, the diaspora story of African-American people is not really a part of my family history because they're all, everybody's still there in Texas. But it is unnerving because I want it to be better than it is. And it has just been captured. I mean, it had a tradition, Ann Richards, it had Ralph Yarbrough, there were liberals, Texas liberals, Jim Hightower, those kind of people, Barbara Jordan, were down there, and that has just been frozen out. But I'm hoping for something better. Annette, definitely.
Annette, anything that I have not asked you that you would like listeners to know about Juneteenth, your journey, what you think it being a national holiday maybe can do for racial reckoning at this time when we are really, ooh, right, we're dealing with race in a way, you know, since 2015. And that dude said, it's okay. You can actually hate openly. And folks slithered out from underneath their rocks.
They did. They did.
Yeah, they were like, and yes!
Yes, now we can say the N-word. We can, right. We can be free. We have free, you know, free speech to do that. I mean, it's really, you know, I try to be an optimistic person. I am an optimistic person. If you have children, if you believe in a future, if you want a future for them, you have to try to maintain that little spark of optimism. But it is tough. It's very, very tough in the face of the kind of retrenchment. I mean, well, as a historian, I should know that I should have expected this because every time there's an advancement, the story of Juneteenth is an advancement, and then there's Reconstruction, and then it's over.
Yep.
Then it's over. I mean, one of the stories that I tell in the book is about finding my great-great-grandfather's name on a voter list in 1867. And I think of, here was this person who had been, started life as treated as an item of chattel, who was now participating in choosing the people who would represent him in government. And I felt pride. I was totally shocked to find it, but pride and happiness, but sadness too, because I knew what was going to happen. You know, 3 years after that, Reconstruction's over, and then it begins the period of Jim Crow, voter suppression, lynching, disfranchisement of African American, first males, and then, you know, later, even when women get the vote, Black women can't vote, still are denied the vote. So I have to be realistic about this because we had a Black president, and even though that didn't change the structure of the government, it really, really frightened a lot of people. And there's a backlash. We're in a period of redemption that's like after the end of slavery and after the end of Reconstruction, where people want to get things back to the way they were before. That's what they're trying. You know, we want to go back to the 1950s or the 1940s before the Civil Rights Movement. And openly doing that, reproductive rights, civil rights, all kinds of things. And there are lots of folks who seem to want to go along with that. So the only thing we can do is resist, but that's the posture we've been in from the very beginning, though.
Yes. Yes, it is. But, you know, we are a resilient people. I think, and that's part of why they look at us in a particular way, because they've tried in so many ways to kill us, to erase us, to disappear us. And we are still here.
Well, that's you know, the story I tell about the five men who build Emancipation Park, because they, you know, or save their money and pool their resources in Houston to buy land for people to celebrate Juneteenth, because they believed, they were just certain that their descendants would recognize the importance of this and would continue to celebrate it. And that becomes Emancipation Park. And I have been to Emancipation Park to celebrate Juneteenth. And this is a legacy. This, they do this in 1875 in the height of really, you know, bad taxes, really terrible lynching, all kinds of things. And they make this gesture of hope, and it continues today. So all we, I think for their sake, we have to kind of keep going. You know, we can't, they didn't give up, and we can't either.
No, we cannot. Fully agree. Annette, I have got to leave it there. You all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Annette Gordon Reed, the Carl M. Loeb University Professor at Harvard, also author of the Pulitzer Prize winning The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She lives in New York and Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her book is on Juneteenth. Annette, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.